When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There's that famous picture of the traveling Wilburys.
Oh yeah, and they're all 42. Roy Orbison's big comeback as an old man. He was, I think, 44 years old or something insane like that. But we were like, my friend said, please God, tell me Irene Ryan was at least over 60 when she did Beverly Hillbillies, and thankfully she was.
Yeah, well, that was a famous thing that that Dustin Hoffman and Anne Bancroft were only 6 years apart in The Graduate. Again, I know we all know this.
Yeah, yes. And Angela Lansbury was only, 2 years older than
James Gregory?
Yes. Lawrence Harvey.
I know who you...
Lawrence Harvey.
And if Wilford Brimley and Cocoon were with us right now, he'd be too young to get any of our references.
Really?
He was 49.
He was old when he started. I don't think he started 49 working.
In Cocoon. Wow.
He didn't start acting until, because he was a stunt guy or something.
Wait, well, he was 42 in Cocoon?
49.
49.
Yeah.
Wow.
Somebody, there was whatever, it was like Mission Impossible 3 and Cocoon. Wilford Brimley and Tom Cruise are the same age in each of those films.
Mm. Holy shit.
But Wilford Brimley was born old.
Yes. Exactly. Some people are just
Like that. Same with Angela Lansbury.
Both of them born with mustaches.
I did a parody of the Quaker Oats ads on the Ben Stiller show. And in makeup, and then later I was on the same episode of Seinfeld with him, and I was genuinely afraid that he knew it was me, because apparently he didn't have a hilariously grand sense of humor about himself. But when I met him, he was just like, Will Brimley. Hi, Will, don't kill me.
So Bobcat, I can't help but notice you have a poster for Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
Oh yeah,
yes.
You know, that is a movie that, you know, when you go back and revisit, because I truly thought that was one of the best movies I'd ever seen in my life. And when I went back, and I told my mother all about it, my mother's patience of a saint, that she listened. And then, it doesn't hold up. It's the song. The song is great. The song is actually really good. But then
by
it goes...
Milton DeLug, who was an accordionist who used to work with Maury Amsterdam on The Breakfast Hour.
Wow. Was he on Fernwood Tonight? Was he?
No, that was
Happy Kind.
No, that was Frank Duvall.
Frank Duvall.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Duvall. Yeah.
But wasn't there Milton DeLug and his band with a thug or something like that? His band with a thud or something like that? I do remember hearing that name on something.
He used to be, he was a sort of a minor player, I believe.
Yeah.
Wow, I realized last time we saw you, Bobcat, we were in the studio, so we didn't see, I assume this is your home. Is that an Evel Knievel lunchbox?
Yeah.
Fantastic. And Rock'em Sock'em Robots.
Right. Yeah, but it's next to a Liberace.
Okay.
It's like a concert program. And I was making, a little movie called Police Academy 3, no biggie. And Paul Mislansky, the producer, was very upset because I said, you know those bad guys that we have at the beginning of the movie? I said, why don't we use the same bad guys to catch at the end of the movie? So I was He went mental on me. He was so mad because I was trying to introduce a plot into Police Academy. It was just, it just seemed so easy though. Do you know what I mean? Just let's hire the same guys. Maybe show, have them show up some. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. All the way around, it's a win-win. And he really got upset with me and he was yelling at me. And I did not engage.
No. Well, you survived.
No, but what I did was I was upset that he yelled at me. So we were in Toronto. I bought a ticket to see Liberace live at Radio City Music Hall. And so the next day I'm not on the set. I didn't make call. And they go, where's Goldthwait? And he goes, oh, he went to New York. What's he doing in New York? He said he was going to go see Liberace. So I showed up 2 hours late and I had all these programs and Liberace scarves and keychains. And I just handed it out to the cast and crew. Sorry about the delay, everybody, but everybody gets a Liberace soap on a rope. He really did sell soap on a rope.
Wait, and then the cowboy, what was the cowboy? I remember that cowboy. I had that. There was a whole.
That was Johnny West.
Johnny West, yeah. Yes.
Johnny West.
The Sears catalog?
Sure.
And you would just they would have pages and pages of epic Johnny West
and
stuff.
Captain Look at that. Maddox. Johnny
Wait,
West,
is that DeForest Kelly as Johnny
yeah.
West?
Yeah. No, Joe, who does like, that look like?
It looks like DeForest Kelly. It does.
Yeah, it does.
It also looks like, I think I'm going to just kill myself today. Yeah. He's the most depressed looking
actor. I'm going to put this 45 right in my mouth. I don't care if Barbie comes back.
If you had to spend your life on Bobcat's shelf, you'd look the same.
Well, no, we got, believe me, they're only talking about two movies. We've got time. And Rock, you must have seen Crooklyn, right? Spike Lee's film?
No.
Oh my God. It's actually my favorite, not his best, obviously, but it's my favorite Spike Lee movie because it is just, it's for people our age, toys, all the TV shows.
That pocket of time.
Rock'em, Sock'em, Robots.
But which two are we going to discuss? Because we did our homework and watched four movies.
Okay. Well, we're talking four movies.
Well,
But wait, more. I need to. Yeah. And then the post, is that Elliot Gould?
No, that's a documentary I did.
That's great. I've seen it. Yeah, no, that's fantastic.
A buddy. I did a documentary on Barry Crimmins he would get so mad if you said he looked like Avery Shriver, but he just looks like Avery Shriver. Who are we kidding? You know, if we're looking, I don't know if I want to show you because this room's a mess, but I never had posters of movies I've made hung up. And we moved and I was like, you know, I'm going to do this. And I went to get a Shakes the Clown poster and I had to get one. I had to buy one because I don't own one. So I buy it online. I never open it up. I get it framed. I go to pick it up and I autographed it. I bought my own autograph on eBay for $45. It says, kill me, Bobcat Goldthwait. It's over there. Let's see if you can see it there. This room doesn't matter. But yeah, that's
fantastic.
It. And I even remember signing the autograph because the guy was kind of a nudge and I just was over his shit. So I wrote, kill me on it.
So if it wasn't autographed, would it have been cheaper or more expensive?
I would like to think I would have preferred the non-autographed one. I said to my girlfriend, I was like, we got to put this in the closet. She's like, no, that's going on the wall.
My girlfriend to Razmi bought an 8x10 of me from like 91 when I was all hair and everything. And it said autographed and she opens it up and she's like, shit. And I went, what? And after I laughed, she goes, it said it's autographed and it isn't.
Oh,
I was like, I can sign it. I'm right here.
It's not the same.
Joe, do you ever see stuff from all the movies you made and how much it goes for? And you go, man, I wish I should have stolen some of that. or at least taken some of it with you, you know?
We just love to make money for other people. I thought we did.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
We just want to make clutter for Bob Burns. That's what we want to do.
my poster, I had I had to call Final Draft once for some technical help on something. It was a few years ago, and I can't imagine. But the History of Violence poster is Viggo and Maria Bello looking, and in the foreground there's a hand holding a gun, a big giant hand holding a gun, And I'm talking to the guy on the thing. And he goes, wait, Josh Olson? I go, yeah. He goes, you made me $100. I go, what? He was the hand in the Ricky of Violence poster. He was so excited.
And he was just as nice. Just didn't go to his head.
No, he's the biggest thing on the poster.
Put his gloves on one hand at a time.
Oh, God damn it. Should we? I don't know.
Who's going to go first?
Do we have to do this?
And John, we've established this. Official? We've established this, Joss. I have that poster that you are sitting in front of.
The very one?
I have the subway, but the same image.
Ah, okay.
From You Only Live Twice. It's a movie with the... movie with the plot of a fever dream. Yes. And I was reading an interview with Peter Hunt, who edited the movie, and he said, I had to cut out every scene where Donald Pleasance moved because he was just mincing. He was just mincing all over the place. So if you see the movie, he's only standing.
That's hilarious.
These and other insights will come to you if you listen to Dana's commentary on Trevor.
That's right. November 1st.
Well, you can tell, because there's a reflection here, and I can't make it quite go away, but James Bond is... he's got prehensile toes on his
shoes.
Yes,
there's no gravity. So there's no gravity at work in that poster.
At a 45 degree angle somehow, because...
Well, you know, speaking of cutting around the action, the moving, one of the movies we were going to talk about was Artists and Models, but what, because I went back and watched it, and what's really kind of interesting in that is I don't remember this happening too much where... for some reason, Frank Tashlin, there's a lot of the gags are off camera. Did you guys remember this or see this? It's really strange. It would be like Jerry Lewis starts to go down a flight of stairs. We don't see him go down the stairs. We hear it. And then a vase is rocking in the background. Mm-hmm. But that happens over and over in that movie.
Like that's from his Warner Brothers cartoon days.
Is it? I mean, but they see the crash. But I always thought like in the cartoons, it was like you saw the crash because it might be too violent.
It's just hard to animate.
Oh, because when I was watching this movie, was Jerry's like going, look, I'm not going down the stairs. I don't know. It was
late. It was the next to last picture.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't speaking. So, you know, anything's possible. But when I was a kid, that was like the greatest movie because it was about comic books.
Yeah,
that's right.
And of course, I was a huge fan, you know, because Bud and Lou were, you know, were not together anymore, really. And,
but did Bat Lady ever end up existing? Did they make
there's a Bat Woman?
Oh, there's a Bat Woman comic.
Right.
That happened after that.
Wow.
Many years after, yes. Should we introduce our guest? Because people have no idea who we're talking to, Joe, or why.
A fat lady.
Well, I think if they can't tell who we're talking to by now, then they don't listen to our show.
It's Bob Scratch Goldfarb.
This is The Movies That Made Me with your hosts, Josh Olson
and Joe Dante.
But it's that's the other thing too. It's just the fat lady jokes. It's I don't know. I mean, it's not like cancel culture, but it's I don't know if we would put that in because of all the movies we did watch, maybe except one. The punchline is that somebody gets stuck with an obese woman.
Yeah, there's a lot of fat shaming in like BLMBG, as I like to call it.
Okay, hang on. So we got these guys. I'm trying to plug your movie.
Okay, we'll shut up.
No. It's fine. What is it? October 29th, right? Is when it comes out?
Yes.
Yeah, Joyride.
Now, it's documentary not the called Joyride. It's not the old Joyride. It's not the one you think of because there's already been a movie called Joyride. Yeah. But this is, and that's.
And there's another movie coming out called Joyride that I don't know. This is the longest. I was just at Western Costume the other day. Work because I'm doing something, and I walk in, and one of the bins is for a thing called Joyride. I'm like, what the fuck?
Oh no! I did a movie called Stay, which I thought was a much better name, and then the company that put it out chickened out because there was a big feature called Stay coming out at the same time. But I kind of wanted that to happen. Like, mm-hmm. I wanted someone to be sitting there going, "Is Naomi Watts going to blow a dog? This is really weird. When is that happening? You know, yeah, you know, I think the most starstruck I got at an audition was Kathleen Freeman was in that little holding pen. And I really couldn't talk to her. I was just like, because
she's really nice. Or she was really nice. I used her a couple of times. And she was just, she told me all these stories about Jerry. Very unflattering, I'm afraid.
But that's how you knew she wasn't lying.
but Jerry was always used her. She was always in.
He used her up until a certain point when he asked her what she thought of something he'd done. And she told him the truth. She said after that, he never came back to her.
Wow.
Well,
so great.
When I was like, I hadn't seen that movie in such a long time, and
Bob, I'm going to stop you.
Are you going to say what movie we're talking about?
No, yeah, Josh.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, let's get this out of the way. The documentary is marvelous.
Thanks.
I've never seen
it. It's called Artists and Models. It's called Joyride.
Yeah. If you're an action junkie, get there early because all the action's in the first 5 minutes.
It's true.
And then it's just these two guys talking in a car and on stage.
Yeah, there is a car crash. I
it's
guess
lovely, though. You know what freaked me? I mean, it's hilarious. Nancy and I were laughing, and she literally had tears coming out of her eyes. But it's if you had told me back when I was sort of enjoying the comic stylings of young Bobcat Goldthwait and Data Gould back in the day, that you two would team up to make such a heartwarming, life-affirming, sweet documentary.
They're really the new Alan and Rossi.
Well,
I'm sure we'll have the same staying power.
We invited them to come on, and I think isn't the idea you're talking about movies with actors who hated each other?
Teams
the new Owens and Samples.
We did pick teams, but the thing is the Dana and I on stage, it was never, you know, I don't know if one of us is the dumb guy. Maybe I'm the dumb guy, and Dana didn't tell me, but you know, it's not that dynamic. By the way, I've always loved that dynamic. I've always, you know, I like you were saying, you know, I loved Evan Costello. I loved Martin and Lewis. I loved Hope and Crosby, all those movies when I was a kid. But we don't do that. There's at no point does Dana point out that baseball players have weird names.
but you can feel the love.
Yeah. I actually do think that's true. I really do. Cause I was trying to think of like, what is it? And I think we do like each other. We do respect each other.
And it's a very frank movie. I mean, you constantly talk about things that you did and said to each other in the past. And
so brutal.
You forgive each other. It's all the while driving in the snow.
Yeah. Well, I make my case to apologize, and Dana just squirms because, you know, I mean, like there's two kinds of Irish Catholic. There's the oppressed Conan O'Brien, Dana Gould, and then there's me and the Pogues, you know, where we drink too much and we cry and we fall in love and we fight and it's all on our sleeves. So I even though we have such similar lives, I think that's basically the difference. You know, it's Goofus and McGallant.
It's a story about a guy I know, very, very similar upbringing and family dynamic, and it's the perfect snapshot. He said to his dad, I love you, and his father went, hey, no problem. It's like I know it well.
Do you know
my
family was always chaos. I don't know if you know my brother's a first AD. I don't know if he's
another
those and
people
it makes,
by nature.
It just makes so much sense because he was always like, you know, if everybody could stop fighting, we could bring the birthday cake out. You know, so I mean, he was like, Mom, is that a Hollywood Five? Or,
Thank you, Five.
Yeah, it just made it. He was always trying to keep everything together, you know, and it kind of makes sense. In fact, we've worked together and he'll go, you know, you're losing the light. You really got to pick it up. And I go, it's a true conversation. I just went, why did Dad give you a car? And he goes, that just came out of you so fast. You must. I go, yeah, man, it's been driving me nuts for 30 years. I didn't get a car. Why would you get, why did you get a car? So cool. Yeah. So my brother's an AD. Sounds like an insult. Your brother's an AD.
The one thing about Joyride that I was thinking about when you look at it is because you do get a concert film. It's Bob and I performing together, and you get all of that stuff that you would get. And then there is historical footage and us talking to each other on the, you know, documentary ways. And what you get from that, it doesn't tell you how we became comedians, but you do get why became comedians. And I think that's not common in a film like this.
And I also think
it's much more psychologically,
Dana has like a mental breakdown, which I was so happy when I found the footage of him freshly out of the hospital and he's like quaking. And it was like, to me, it was as if it was like backlit, like, oh, here's Dana. Yeah. Actually, that's how I felt when I saw the Bob Hope footage. But and then I have a public kind of breakdown. His was inside, mine was outside. But you know, I think like when you watch comedy, even like when I'm watching people I really admire and like, there's a fatigue that settles in at about the 45 minute mark. And I hope that this movie kind of skirts around that because.
Well, it's only 70 minutes long, which is
it's like, 70 minutes long on purpose.
Same running time as Bela Lugosi meets a Brooklyn gorilla.
Coincidence?
Joe, that might be the best segue you've ever done.
You're supposed to hide your influences, but I'm all in. Let's talk. One of the things I find fascinating about that movie is that they use their first and last names as the characters.
Yes.
it's like watching Sleepless in Seattle and it's my name's Tom Hanks, hi, you know, it's just lazy writing, but
they probably couldn't remember the real names.
Who was it? Wasn't it, and I don't mean to bad with the gentleman, but didn't like Tony Danza always have to be named Tony on his shows because he would forget his character's probably. Name
and I don't know how much this was lore
that tracks, but, I had never heard it, but
but it does say that Bella was calling Sammy Jerry all the time. I read that. I don't know if it's true or not, but I think like I don't think it says it's 12 grand, but it has to be a lot more.
No, it was more than that.
Yeah, that it can't be. Yeah, I mean the gorilla suits alone.
The weird though is I you're right, they have their names, but Bela Lugosi, who is in the title of the film, is not Bela Lugosi in the movie. He's Dr. Zabor.
That's one of the great things about the movie.
Here's a story, man. When I heard this, I went, well, I'll run it by Joe because I don't know if this, but that purportedly, there was a sort of Bialystok and Bloom aspect to this that was it Maurice Duke, the producer? Maurice Duke's plan was, because this came out right when my friend Irma and is it Irma Goes West? Is that
Yeah,
it?
My friend Irma Goes West.
Right. It came out and was a big, big hit. And they were, and the hope was, we're going to make this and we'll sell it to Paramount. So they can lock it up. And then Paramount gave them a potential offer. And Maurice Duke's partner, Jack Broder, went like, no, it's not enough. And Maurice Duke's like, you idiot.
Now we got to put this movie out.
Yes. And then Jerry Lewis at first, and there's a long, you know, there's a story of how Jerry became from a, you know, Jerry knew Sammy. They did a sketch together on the Milton Berle show.
Sammy played him as a baby or something.
Right.
Yeah.
And he was a baby. He was 17. But I guess Jerry watched the film and he went, all right, you can release it. Good luck.
Yeah. Well, when and here's a spoiler. When Sammy gets shot in the film, Jerry allegedly yelled out, thank God. But you know, I was wondering, like, when I first was watching it, you know, had this been like a case of like Delicate Delinquent, where it was all set up to be a Martin and Lewis film, Do you know what I mean? But it's right, like, no, yeah. This was not set up to be a Martin Lewis film. This was just people saying, hey, we could do that.
Yeah. And
I've got a couple of problems with the movie. The people on this island speak some gibberish and then they speak English. And it's never explained. They just speak this gibberish and then sometimes they speak English. And it's I guess it's supposed to be I'm guessing they're on their way to Guam. So I guess it's some
Polynesian
sort of,
island. Because
so it's a Polynesian.
You want to have Polynesian natives. You don't want to have black natives. Or Asian natives.
Right. And also, Dr. Zabor's big experiment is he has a serum that can turn a man into a gorilla.
Right.
Why?
I feel like there's a gain of function joke in there. That's
I feel like
there.
That's more of a prank than a scientific experiment.
But then when he gives it to the woman, she turns into a chimp.
Women, right?
That's when I knew this was fake.
That's when you call bullshit? Fake. Fake. So fake.
But it is... For those people listening at home who have never seen Bela Lugosi meets a Brooklyn Gorilla,
I was going to say, could you give a little?
You would do it a better job than I will. But it was just, it came out at the very on the uptick of Martin and Lewis's not only success but dominance. I mean, there isn't a cultural analogy today in terms of how big they were.
It would be like that, remember that run about 7-8 years that Jim Carrey had where he was just, so then you got to make that go 10 years and then another 10 as solo artists. It's just insane how big they were.
And in terms of comedy, like there was nobody could touch them. And they found these people made a Martin and Lewis movie without Martin and Lewis. And I don't even know if it was because if it's legal, but it would have been a very interesting court case. Can you copyright a persona? Because they did get cease and desist letters from Paramount.
But it is also, it is strange and shocking how similar he is to Jerry.
Yes.
When I was a kid, I saw that picture on television and I thought it was a Martin and Lewis movie.
Yeah.
I had only been familiar with him from the movies and from TV, but the Martin and Lewis from TV is completely different than Martin and Lewis in the movies because the whole act really hinged on the fact that they were completely crazy and did this nightclub stuff where he sang and got heckled and they threw pies and they did all this. It was very Olsen and Johnson in a way.
But you know what's funny? It's like when I watched those Colgate, sorry, cutting you off, but I watched the television, Dean's getting laughs. He's getting lots of laughs and he's being really funny. And he's not as funny as he is in the movies as he is live.
But he also seems to be having a good time because this was back when they were really riding high on the high and they were getting, you know, they were dropping thousands of stills from the Paramount Theater window to all those kids. And I mean, they were like the Beatles in a way.
Yeah, they really were. And you can go into Inside Baseball about, you know, you need Dean Martin with Jerry Lewis at that point to provide ballast.
Right.
And as a leavening agent almost, you know, it's like the way people will put water in whiskey to just kind of cut it a little bit. It's that you needed that balance and that he's a very, he lets you exhale a little bit.
But he's genuinely really funny.
The theory was later when he became a part of the Rat Pack that everybody wanted to be Frank except Frank who wanted to be Dean. Because Dean, if you listen to those old recordings, he's effortlessly hilarious. Dean Martin was the one that would come out and look at pretending to be drunk, look at the audience and go, "How'd you all get into my room?" And that would get a big laugh. And then Sinatra would do it and it would come across like a threat. Like, "How'd you get in my room?" Like, he didn't understand the nuance of a joke.
We paid tickets. What do you... I mean, now, I'm sure this is lore. Maybe... maybe one of you guys know. It's the story about Dean and Jerry walking through the Paramount lot, and they're in sailor suits, and Dean says to Jerry, "So we're in the Navy this time." Like, so we're in the Navy? Like, he clearly could not give a shit. And I just love that. So back to this movie, though. I actually wonder, Sammy is such a fascinating character. Like, you have this talent, and your talent is just being so much like this other person. And then you're going to get crushed if you use it. I mean, he seems like a real tragic figure, you know? It's like, remember that guy who impersonated Nixon? Remember that guy?
Oh, yeah. David Fry. Yeah.
No, there's a guy who changed his name to Dixon.
Richard M. Dixon.
Yeah, Richard M. Dixon.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's awful.
But
the real sad sack is Vaughn Meter.
Yeah.
Wait, who
well,
is
somebody
he?
Was...
Well, the guy who did the first family.
Yeah.
Oh. And the record, The First Family, was a huge hit. And his career was like, wow, I'm going to, my whole career, I'm going to be JFK.
Four more years of this.
And then, unfortunately.
Well, that was the famous show. Lenny Bruce walked on stage November 24th with poor Vaughn Meter.
Yeah.
Too soon.
But there was, to Dana's question, wasn't there a case like 20 years ago where was it a coffee company was using a VO artist who sounded exactly like Tom Waits, and Tom Waits sued and won?
Doritos,
that was it. Yeah. So apparently there are legal precedents for being able to do that.
Yeah. Sammy went on to narrate nudie films such as Keyholes Are for Peeping.
It's true.
Yeah.
Pee holes are for, did he, what did he do it in character? Did he do it as?
You can hear him. He sounds a lot like Sammy. And apparently he's in The Brain That Wouldn't Die, which is.
I've never spotted him.
Yeah.
Really?
He's listed. It's in his IMDb. That's an underrated movie, by the way.
So he's also, he ran a comedy club in Pittsburgh called The Nut House, which started, I don't know. I want to find out. Like Dennis Miller would play there, and
maybe,
and Pryor.
Standard line: hard to believe the occupation that gave the world Jack Ruby could produce some unsavory character.
but you know, as stand-up comedians, our tax forms look like we're clowns. Yeah. The Nut House. Yeah.
Sir
Laughs.
Sir Laughs. These are real clubs. Yeah, there was a Sir Laughs a Lot.
Oh. Uncle, what is that? Uncle.
Uncle Fucker's Chuckle Hutch was.
No, there's an Uncle. There's like an Uncle Funny, which was
Uncle Funnies. Uncle Funnies.
Yeah, which was always Ann Landers slang for a pedophile in the family. You know, you have a funny uncle.
Funny uncle. That's right.
I don't get this joke. This is horrible. When does this get funny? When does this get funny, Uncle Gary?
Yeah. Well, even in Burr, there's a nice comedy club in Burbank, California, and the people that run it are the best. But it's called Flappers.
And I'm like, yes.
What are you doing tonight, Daddy?
Going nothing.
It's a last scrap of dignity I'm playing in St. Louis coming up. So,
well, and then nobody's talking about Duke Mitchell, who was his own.
Yeah.
Who actually had a career more or less after that.
Yeah. And was not into being an ersatz Dean Martin at all. Had no interest in
Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he's also like that, you know, I guess that's the thing. And that, you know, we'll talk about Abbott and Costello later, but obviously you can't make these pairs. You have to have that thing where the people love each other. It's just, you can't create it. You can try. But there's, he's not like a Dean Martin. He just happens to be an Italian looking guy who sings, but he's not a
boomba.
But he should have been in the
Soprano.
Bob pointed out, it's really true that he's really doing Tony Curtis.
Yeah, he's not doing Dean Martin, and his pipes, he's not a crooner. He's like got this big thing, but it's really funny. It's like when Dean goes to the song, he's in it. He's singing to the people. It's funny. We're going to talk about artists and models. It's funny to see him doing choreography Yeah. You know, you don't think of him dancing, but he's actually doing choreography. And this guy is just, it's like, it's that, it's so dropped in the song, and it's just big and loud. And I don't know, man.
Cut out, make.
So nobody here knows like what the reaction was on release, do we?
There wasn't much of a release.
Yeah, it wasn't much of a release.
It was on TV so quick. Like the year later.
It actually caused a problem with SAG because it was on TV while it was still in some theaters, and that got flagged by the Screen Actors Guild. Maurice Duke, who produced it, who seems to be somewhat of a legendary figure, was 5'1", had polio, produced a lot of stuff, was friends with Shemp Howard, and he had a special car.
What you're saying is he pulled a lot of wool.
Yes.
The ladies loved him.
He did. Yes.
I'm not talking about polio and being 5'1".
Just like
when Shemp's your wingman, I can't. Shemp's
your wingman. But he was a producer and used his power. He wasn't taking Grace Kelly home, but he, a lot of the jungle gals in Bella met the underside of Maurice Duke. He would purportedly drive around town. He had a specially made car with hand brakes and hand accelerants because he had polio. Wow. And he would drive around, and Shemp Howard would apparently scream out the window of the car, "Help, help, a cripple's driving the car. Help, help, a cripple's driving the car." And he was friends with Jerry. He was friends with Jerry Lewis. And it's quite an interesting story. His goal was to release the film without their names on the poster or the marquee, and just to hope people would think they were seeing. And if it wasn't for Duke, I would totally believe that was like,
the way
the Knickerbockers sounded like the Beatles so much that it's surprising that's not a Beatles song. They're one hit.
Did Bella have to read for it? He's like, "What are you going? I'm going in for this thing tomorrow. What? It's called Bella Lugosi. I don't know why they're making me audition. It's called Bella Lugosi. The Brooklyn Grand. I still got to read for it. I don't know. I'll do my best."
Yeah. And then he just sees like an old script for the side, say Lionel Atwill meets a Brooklyn gorilla, and like, "Oh, I see what's going on here."
I'm thinking about those weird, awkward dinners with the producer and his buddy Jerry Lewis when Jerry's like, what are you working on?
It's crazy, but
it's
pretty
incestuous business.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, he was very much a larger than life for 5'1", he was a larger than life character, to be sure.
Well, so I'll try to do an abbreviated version of this. My Jerry story. I don't know if you know this story. I was on a benefit in London at the Palladium, and Jerry Lewis was headlining. And you know what? I might not tell this story.
Oh, come on!
Stop! I'm gonna stop. Jeez. I'm gonna stop. But it's for legal reasons, and I just remembered halfway through, I was like, "Oh yeah, someone involved in the story isn't wearing a white hat," and he gets very paranoid and crazy when I tell the story. So when someone else told the story, but I will say this: Jerry was super sweet to me, and I got to sit in a dressing room with him in London Palladium, and he, knees together, and he was just regaling me stories with Dean and him, and just a doll. Like, I didn't get the dark side.
Yeah,
it was so crazy for me. I was because I was waiting for that. I was like, "Oh, this is gonna be horrible," you know. Knock, 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 and I got the really nice Jerry.
And he must have.
I pulled the. I can't tell that story.
But he must have gotten what you were doing. He understood that it's a parody.
Basically a knockoff.
no, it's like we've talked about this before. Like, you know, Bob's Bob's that the persona in the 80s, it was a parody of stand-up comedy. It's like, who is the last person on earth that should be doing stand-up comedy? This person. And but, you know, I'm sure Jerry got that.
But, you know, one of the things I can say, you know, get us into that other movie, was truly when I was a kid, I would watch Lou Costello, and I didn't really laugh, but I really liked him. And I was more like, this guy, I like this guy's got good chops. I like his acting. Like I, and now going back and watching it, it's like Lou is very, he's a child. He is infantile. Sometimes people would say that about Jerry, but that's not true. And with you know, with Bud yelling at him all the time, it's like, yeah, that's what a kid sees. You know, you're getting yelled at, you're always wrong, you're seeing things, you're not sure they're real. He is a child, where Jerry's just anarchy. Jerry's just Jerry's just all the Marx Brothers rolled into one.
Yeah. What's interesting is that Jerry was a big fan of Charlie Chaplin. And Charlie Chaplin had his own Sammy Petrillo. There was a guy named Billy West, not our Billy West.
Not our Billy West. Yeah.
But there was a guy named Billy West in the time of Chaplin that was just a Chaplin knockoff that was a poor man's Charlie Chaplin.
I was the biggest Chaplin fan in the universe when I was a kid. I've never heard of this guy. Semi-successful Charlie Chaplin impersonator.
Semi-successful. There you are.
That's how I knew him. I met him at the meetings.
That's gonna be my new gravestone. Semi-successful. But yeah, I guess you could. Was he doing like vaudeville? I mean, it'd be easy to impersonate musical. Him.
Yeah. I guess I don't know that much about him. I do think it's funny. It's like, you know, you wanted to be just like Chaplin, and you get the bad stuff too. Although all of Jerry's paramours seem to be of age.
Yeah.
So the other movie, well, one of the movies is going back to Abbott and Costello. I'm sure you guys probably talk about this a lot.
Not with you.
Meet Frankenstein.
Well, yes. It has come up on occasion, and it is a favorite, and it's probably the one movie that they made that has outlasted all the others, even though it may not necessarily be the best one.
It's not as funny, but maybe it lasts because there's just more of a structure.
How is it the greatest movie ever made, and yet it's not their best movie? I'm having trouble with this, Joe.
No, I didn't say it was the greatest movie ever made.
No, I'm saying this is an empirical fact.
I'm just saying that I think Whodunit is a better movie. You know, first of all, there's no music, which is another thing about Meet Frankenstein, is that they didn't have the musical numbers. And when I was a kid, it always drove me nuts that they had to stop the comedy. It was true with the Marx Brothers too. And they stop the comedy and they do songs and stuff.
There are more songs. Artists and Models has more songs than Let It Be. I mean, Artists and Models has a song every 35 seconds.
I had written a thing that will never get made or anything, but it was about like Abbott Costello like team, and then this movie, and it was based on what I think happened to Abbott Costello. They had the sets and stuff from the hits. So in my movie, these two guys got stuck doing Frank and Sippy, where Frankenstein is a riverboat gambler, and then there was Hitler Ahoy. Hitler was a U-boat captain. They would have all these sets, and then they were the big money maker for the studio, but they had no rhyme and reason.
Hitler Ahoy.
Frank and Zippy was like, they're playing cards. Hit me. Hit me. Do you this is the first time, because I really love Young Frankenstein. Do you think that any of that is influenced by that movie? Young Frankenstein influenced anything by Abbott Costello Meet Frankenstein?
Vice versa, you mean?
What's that? Yeah, I mean, do you think Mel's influenced it? Or
well, Mel saw all these movies and he liked them all, and he's very fastidious in the movies that he uses stuff from, all the bases jokes on, and uses sets and all that kind of stuff. And I was always surprised he didn't do the picture in 1:33 square, you know, that he did it in widescreen. It just seemed odd to me why he would do that, because he was so meticulous about trying to make it look like.
I'd imagine it was hard enough getting them to give him a go ahead to do it in.
Well, and it was originally at Columbia, and then they didn't make it because he wanted to do it in black and white.
Right.
Same with Ed Wood, originally at Columbia, yeah. And they didn't want to make it in black and white.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. And Young Frankenstein also was originally Gene's idea.
Yeah. Then he woke up and wrote on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And it's much better known now than any of the Frankenstein movies are.
Yeah. But it's such a love letter to the specific, to the universal ones, the straight ones. It seems to me right. That they would have gone out of their way to avoid any conscious.
It was just a couple gags that kind of, you know, the spinning secret.
That's true.
Spinning
that's
secret
true.
Door. And then I happened to notice how giant the knocker was. On the front door. And I was like, I wonder if Mel saw that and said, that's a big knocker.
Well, isn't that in Son of Frankenstein or the enormous, I mean, there's so much of it is in
probably.
That
probably.
He took a lot of stuff. The whole thing with the inspector is all from yeah. Frankenstein.
It's from which one?
Son of Frankenstein.
Okay. I remember watching Son of Frankenstein, I think last
played,
year.
Played by Lionel Atwill. There we go. Yep.
Full circle.
But I remember watching it and there's a giant knocker on a door and I was watching with a bunch of friends and just everybody just burst out laughing. There was nobody need to say anything. You knew exactly what it was.
What's interesting too, you know, Bela Lugosi famously was not in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. They cast another guy that had never even played Dracula before. Universal didn't think it mattered who played Dracula. They were not interested in Bela Lugosi playing Dracula, and I forget who it was, but somebody kind of leaned on him with basically, give the guy a break, will you? He made you guys a lot of money. And Joe, you might know who I'm talking about, but it's I read it in some David Scal book.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff in those books. They Bela had also been given the short shrift by Universal on Son of Frankenstein. And they were gonna lowball him and not pay him much money. And so the director Roland V. Lee took his side and completely threw out the script and added this character that Bela plays, Igor, one of his best performances.
Yeah. That's
and
the thing.
That was all added. Well, that was never in the original script or the original plan. And he worked it so that he worked incessantly so that Bela could actually take home some money. And it was really a wonderful gesture, and it made the movie much better.
It made the movie much better. That's the thing. People always say that Bela Lugosi was sort of a hammy actor, sort of a mannered bad actor. He is phenomenal in Son of Frankenstein. That is not an easy role. Not an easy role. And he's great. He's great in that movie.
I have homework. I've never seen this. I need to see.
Really?
Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah.
It's the it's the longest and most elaborate Frankenstein movie. Wow. In fact, there's so many. We did the trailer for Trailers from Hell, and they found an original trailer, and it's full of scenes because it was cut while the movie was being shot. Full of scenes that aren't in the movie. So the movie is like 99 minutes long already. And
wow.
And it must have at one point been even longer. And they what's more, they rushed it through to the point where it was like finished shooting in December and it was released at the end of January. I mean, wow. It was just an amazing job of sticking this thing together. And it has a great score, which was used for 10 years after that.
Yeah, Franz Waxman's score.
I think it's Frank Skinner, but it's okay. It's a wonderful picture. It's not like the previous two pictures. It's actually quite a different movie.
Well, it's also very much structurally, it's Young Frankenstein.
Structurally, it's Young Frankenstein.
You'll be amazed at how much.
Yes. Oh, okay. Structurally, and the sets are very expressionistic. There's a lot of.
They're great sets, and they really defined the look of all those Universal pictures after that.
Yeah, and the inspector from Young Frankenstein, Kenny Mars, that's from Son of Frankenstein. Yeah,
almost and verbatim. It's hilarious.
And yes, it is amazing. And the famous look of Frankenstein wearing like a fur sleeveless sweater is from Son of Frankenstein. I don't know why that was there, but that's there.
Well, I have my homework to do.
It's a lot of fun. You'll really like it.
It really is, yeah.
But, you know, going back and getting ready for this and watching these movies, it is fascinating to me how Bud Abbott is, you know, Martin and Lewis, they're in love, and they're two guys that would hang out together.
Yeah.
Bud is just babysitting Lou. He just hates him.
It's just an abusive marriage. It really
it's not
is
even a marriage though. It's like a stepdad, you know, and mom's out at a girl's weekend and he hates this kid, you know.
Yes.
He just hates this kid. You know, Dana and I were talking, it's like there's a big emphasis in stand-up comedy to because like you could discover a comedian you never heard of, and then one night you sit there and click and you've watched 8 hours of their entire catalog. So people are considered great comedians because they come up with this new hour. And I think of like Abbott and Costello, you know, they wouldn't have had the time to perfect, you know, Who's on First or, you know, any of their bits. I mean, I know Who's on First wasn't theirs, but to get it in that kind of shape and that kind of timing and stuff.
Well, they were also on the radio. You know, they had a lot of radio experience, and they tried out a lot of those things on the radio. But the shtick came mainly from John Grant, who was their main writer. And when they were doing, if you look at like the first picture, not the first one, but the first big one was Buck Privates, the relationship between the two of them is so much as you described, but it's much easier. It's much simpler. It's like they just click. I mean, they're just so good together, and the timing is so perfect. And then they sort of build on that in the succeeding movies. But the problem became that Universal just kept wanting to repeat the same stuff over and over and over. So all the movies through the 40s they're semi interchangeable. You know, I mean, it's okay. This one's in the Navy, and this one's on a college campus, and this one is, you know, but it's just an excuse to get them to do their stuff, which was remarkably similar to the point where they did their TV show in the 50s. They really basically recycled all the material from their old movies without the songs, and did it on the Hal Roach backlot, and it's sort of a compendium of vaudeville shtick. And of course, they had their vaudeville friends on with them, and the Who's on First routine, and the Susquehanna hat routine, right, which is one of the greatest of all time, which is in Society is the name of the movie, but it which is the best version of it, I think. But they all reappear. All these piano gags and stuff, they all reappear in the TV show.
I was fascinating to hear you say, who was the guy that was like their gag man?
John Grant.
Because like I was watching that, and it's like it didn't feel like it could be on the page, but I also know they didn't just show up on the set and ad lib this stuff, because some of it's just purely physical, purely versions of different takes and stuff.
Well, they used to ad lib a little, because that's one of the reasons that they had more than two cameras. They had one on the two of them and one on Lou. And because they never, but the Abbott's great talent was getting Lou back on track if he went off the wrong way. And plus Bud was epileptic. So he, you know, it was probably twice as hard for him to do that toward the end. And that's one of the reasons he drank so much.
Wow.
I didn't know that.
I've appeared in I don't really like being on camera, and I don't like, this is different, this documentary being in something I direct. I would rather not do that at all. But sometimes when I'm in stuff that I'm directing, and I did this in this movie, I will move people around so they're on their mark. Like I'm hugging Dana and I'm staring because he keeps getting out of the light. I've done this in a it's not good. It's
I know. Really... I've done it too, and I can. I it's just a thing you do. It's like, and let me tell you, actors don't like that. They hate that. And if you're guesting a guest director on somebody's show, and you go up to one of the regulars and touch them, and move them, that is not a good idea.
Oh, that was I was on Community, and And there at the time I did it, you know, they're this well-oiled machine, you know, they, right. So Joel McHale flubs and he just picks up the scene and I'm behind the wall. And I didn't know this. This was probably the first setup of the day, first day on the thing. And I go, hey Joel, I say action. And I wasn't being a dick and the whole cast went, whoa. But then at the end of the day, they were like, this is the first day we ever wrapped early. Well, okay.
They liked that too, I must
admit. Yeah, they really liked that. They were like weeping when I left. They were like, oh.
Here's something even more embarrassing. When we were doing an episode of Stand Against Evil that I had written and was also in. And we did a take where it's a bunch of characters. And after the take, the director said, great, now let's do one where Dana isn't mouthing everyone's dialogue with them.
Oh. I've never seen an adult do that. I've only ever seen some kid actors.
I wanted to throw myself off a bridge.
I had a kid actor. I once had to cut around because she was always, you know, I should have caught it because I didn't. She'd be going. But this is something that's probably a little surprising, and is that David Bowie and myself had very serious discussions about doing a double act, about going up on stage, to the point where he had written some music and in fact like a year later I would have done it. Because I got to the point where I was opening for Nirvana and stuff, because I just thought it'd be funny to go out and eat shit in front of 6,000 people, which to me that was pretty, you know, that was kind of meta. But yeah, David and I talked really seriously about this, and he said, so I booked a couple small theaters, and I'm like, 2,000 seats. It's like, you can't be on the bill. It has to be me doing stand up. He walks out, people go nuts, and then he tries to sing, and then I ruin it, you know? But we definitely talked about it because he liked to laugh. And I think, like, you know, like I would bust his chops a fair bit. And people don't think of him as someone with a sense of humor, but he would laugh. And he was telling me, the story of all the young dudes. He goes, I was in my car and I heard that Mata Hoople broke up. And I thought, if I go home and write a hit song, maybe they'll stay together to record it. And he tells me the story in a studio. And I was like, well, why don't you bust out some of that shit in here? If you could just decide to write a hit song.
I just like, it's funny, like, to do the Martin and Lewis, but it's you and Bowie, like, ground control. Sing it louder, you limey greaseball.
With a big cock on it. Well, you know, so he invites me and I take Tom Kenny to go see that Glass Spider tour, you know, and it's not, you know, whatever. He says, so what you think? I go, it's like watching, Tom thought it was Angels in America, but I thought it was more like Guys and Dolls. And he's looking at us and he doesn't laugh. And he's like, he's going through this Rolodex. He's like, what is this sensation? Oh, someone's making fun of me to my face. I haven't felt that. I haven't felt that in 30 years. So then he laughed really hard and we became pals. And he used to come over the house and he'd be in the rumpus room. I had all this musical equipment. My brother, when he passed away, he goes, do you remember when you made Bowie play drums? I was like, yeah, because he wanted to sing. And I was like, no, we need a drummer. It turns out he could actually play drums really well. But Dana and I are on stage together and I'm glad you guys like it and it seems to work. But back when I was doing the persona that I did, I kind of always did want to find my Dean, you know, and I never did, you know.
What would that have to be, just a complete straight man, right?
I don't, have you guys ever watched Mighty Boosh? Do you know them?
Sure, yeah.
Because I feel that they're as close as that could ever be, you know. They're pretty great.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Danny, you want to talk about more movies?
I was saying that you know, what you do, what you have in Artists and Models and Abbott Costello Meet Frankenstein, it's really the you know, the template of it's really or and you know, it's a ventriloquist and his dummy. It's the guy trying to get the point across and then the force of anarchy on his lap. Like, you know, it's Dean and Jerry's act is really like a ventriloquist act. It's like, nah, don't say that to these nice people. I'm trying to get this song across. Yeah, the Mighty Boosh's were the last time you had that. What we're doing is we're just doing our acts and we're doing our acts in tandem and interacting with each other, but we don't have any, we're not a two-man act.
Well, that's it was exactly interesting. I'd not
seen anything like that before, and there's not so much of it in the film that I have a sense of what an entire night with the two of you would have been like. But yeah, it seems like you're each sort of doing your own bits while the other guy stands there and pokes at him every now and
then. Yeah, yeah.
Which is kind of great.
Well, but they also stand and appreciate each other. Which
is very much
entertaining in itself.
Yeah,
and you can always tell by the fact that the headgear changes from shot to shot how many different places they've really gone to.
Was there any rule at all? I know we're not supposed to ask about this stuff. We're supposed to talk about movies, but was there any kind of rule where like, okay, but when I'm doing this bit, you need to shut the fuck up? It was just
we never really discussed it at all. Go ahead, Bob.
No, it'd be what we just did. That it would be almost bad. It would be kind of like Chip and Dale. It'd be like, after you. No, after you. You know, it's like, what happened to me? When did I get neutered?
Well, you said, Bob said this in earlier, and it's really true. Like, you know, I don't think we could have done this 10 years ago. I think that we needed to get.
You weren't who you are now 10 years ago.
Well, but I don't think we were as comfortable sharing the spotlight 10 years ago. You know, it's like there's a reason that comedians work solo. It's like that's the level of my collaborative ability to be in the microphone.
Turns out comics are great listeners.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, comedy is based on this. Someone walks into a club and goes, you know what this room needs? Me up there and everyone listening.
Yeah,
that would make this better. That's a big ego. That's insanity.
Yeah, and it's really true. And you know, to get to the point where, you know, you can be in the parade or you can watch the parade and they're both satisfying is the point that we had to get to. But in terms of how what you see in Joyride developed, Bob and I were touring together just because we wanted to tour together, because one, our combined fan bases would allow us to fill a rock club, so we didn't have to go to a comedy club for the weekend. We could do one night in the big venue and move on. And two, we enjoy each other's company and thought it would be fun to travel together. It beats traveling alone. And then we would go on stage, kind of hack around for a few minutes, and then we would flip a coin to see who would go first and who would go second. And that hacking around just got longer and longer and longer, and the people enjoyed it more.
It became so obvious. It's like they liked us just dicking around together a lot more than our acts. And we both said we got to jettison doing the acts.
Yeah, we were in Maryland, and we just said, let's try to stay on stage together the whole time. And that was all of the planning that was in that statement.
That was like was it the 300 club or 500 club? Where did Martin and Lewis get together? It was like in Atlantic City. Joe, did you, and I don't know if it would even make sense, did you ever meet Frank Tashlin?
No, never did.
Oh, yeah.
No, I would have loved to, but no, I never did.
Because, I mean, do you see a similarity in your work and his?
I've been told.
Oh, really?
No, actually, there's a guy named Ethan DeSeef who wrote a book about Tashlin, and one of the chapters is actually about me as a person who has inherited the mantle.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I mean, I love Frank Tashman and I love your stuff. So, but I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I do.
There's a lot of Tashman gags and Gremlins comes to mind easily.
I really appreciate Tashman because I encountered his cartoons before I knew who he was. And I'd seen, of course, the Martin Lewis movies before I knew who he was either. But the ones that he did, I think, are much more interesting, even though they tend to be the later ones where they weren't getting along. But maybe that tension actually helps the movies.
Are they not getting along in Artists and Models?
No, they were not getting not as bad as in Hollywood or Bust, where they literally weren't speaking.
But I think it's like, I wonder if that's what gave Tashman the window to come up with these big gags and visuals. You know, if you got two actors that don't want to be together.
I think Jerry was chafing at the bit to direct, and I'm sure he was. He obviously was friendly with Tashman because he went on and did pictures with Tashman after they broke up. But it was pretty apparent that he's studying and watching and learned a lot of stuff from Tashman.
A lot of the gags are kind of the big visual gags that seem like they're very similar.
Yeah.
What's the one where did Jerry direct the one where he's in the house with all the women and he's
the ladies' man? That's Jerry. That's the one that is Jerry. The big cutaway house.
Yeah, but that gag where he smears the paint on he's cleaning the painting and it just smears it.
Yeah,
that felt very.
He used to credit Tashman all the time for I learned all this stuff from Frank. Apparently, he didn't learn a lot from Norman Taragg or some of those other guys. They just sort of putting him through their paces. But what was interesting is that even at when they were having, there was so much stories about how they weren't getting along, and they made this Western called Partners, which Tashman didn't direct. And the last scene in the movie is them sitting down and talking to the audience and saying, "Don't worry, we love each other. We're going to stay together always."
Oh.
And then they sing this song about where we'll always be partners, we'll always be pals, you know. And it was sort of like, even as a kid, I wasn't sure.
You didn't buy it. Where's the "What would you do without me? What did you do, boy?" Where's that one from? You know that? That was always the.
Do just fine.
I'll have a tiny slump at the beginning and you'll eclipse me and then I'll come back and do really well.
Well, there's a bit in Artists and Models, because I watched it again recently and I was wondering, I was like, is this the bit where they're doing their routine and they're painting mustaches on each other's faces? Mm-hmm. And Dean looks at Jerry and Jerry looks at Dean, and just like the sheer love exuding from them is palpable, but you also realize, but the other guy isn't in the shot. Like,
right.
What is Jerry actually looking at?
Oh.
But it's beautifully cut, and it just you just feel this love. And if you were, if I was like a 12-year-old kid watching that movie, like, they like each other. But then you grow up and you realize you need to see if the other guy is there or not.
When I watched it again, I realized, this is why I've always had a thing for Shirley MacLaine.
Oh,
she's all in. She's all in. She's flopping around. When they do a little duet, she's actually even doing Jerry a little bit back. I mean, she's just all in. And and that was my dream. You know, I was
right after working for Hitchcock.
Trouble with Harry.
Really? And then goes on to that set. Kind of awesome.
We're going to get back to Bobcat's amazing segue in just a minute. But first, we want to pause to thank our sponsor, MoviesUnlimited.com, the movie collector's website. They are not only huge fans of our show, but they feature many of the movies we discuss here. In fact, they have multiple editions of Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla. So there you go. You can easily find the movies we discuss here and add them to your collection. Sure, you can stream a lot of stuff these days, but when you buy your favorites, you watch what you want, when you want, and there's usually a ton of great content and bonus features like director's commentary, deleted scenes, and all sorts of goodness. Although, as far as I can tell, nobody's ever done that with Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla, which is truly our loss.
Up to anything? No? Good. Then you have time to click the Movies Unlimited banner on our Trailers from Hell website and buy your favorites from hard-to-find films, imports, and more. Go now to moviesunlimited.com, the movie collector's website, where shipping is always free on orders over $50.
Also, should mention the entire month of October, it's a haunted Halloween with scary good deals on everything horror. So support our sponsor and head over to moviesunlimited.com, the movie collector's website.
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
One particular argument, he ended up dislocating Ava's jaw. Ava, she was such a tough cookie. Rather than cry or scream or anything like that, she...
Or call the police,
like she should have, exactly. Exactly. What does she do? She takes an ashtray and she knocks him over the head and knocks him unconscious. That's how she fought back. She didn't know what to do, so she called Louis B. Mayer. I think I've killed Howard Hughes. What do I do?
Revisit a time when the pictures were still big and everyone was ready for their close-up. When you want Tyrone Power instead of Tom Hardy, Jennifer Jones instead of Jennifer Lawrence, or Robert Mitchum rather than Robert Pattinson, then From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
And now back to our show.
Well, speaking of people going from insane sets, that's a good segue to to a little. You want to bring it up?
Oh yeah, we were talking about, you know, because of this movie and partner movies, and or as they call them in the business, Joe, you might not know this, two-handers. It's a phrase, one of my favorite. Two-handers. There was this weird period in the early 70s of these bizarre character dramas. Another example would be Scarecrow with Gene Hackman and Al Pacino. And this is another one. I remember watching it as a kid on TV late at night, and I just thought it was the strangest goddamn movie I'd ever seen. It's called Little Foss and Big Halsey.
Oh, yeah.
And... I rewatched it in preparation for this. It's as weird as I remember it.
Yes.
It has the best. It starts with Johnny Cash singing what has to be the best song ever written about dirt bikes. in the same way that Clam Bake is by right. far the best song ever written about a clam bake.
So we should say it's Robert Redford and Michael J. Pollard.
And Robert Redford plays, pardon my language, a piece of shit.
Oh, he's such a dick.
He just plays an unrepentant asshole in this movie. And this is after Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, or he might have made it before it and came out after, but it's 6-7.
No, it was the success of Butch Cassidy. That's why he wanted to play quote unquote something grimy. Well achieved. look, we all like anti-hero films. Maybe you guys can help me. What is missing that he is so like, I really don't like this person. Like he really should just be a villain because he's so despicable. And yeah. By the way, hats off, all apologies to Dice Clay, because there is skill involved in being a misogynistic character that people relate to, because this is a misogynistic right. character that I want.
It can get you elected president.
right. Yeah. It's just, it's true. It's very strange. And then I even went down and started looking up positive reviews for it that called it funny. And it is not funny.
Not funny. It's horrible.
It does not have a light touch. If there's a joke, we talk about it. Then we do the punchline and then we come back and then bring up the punchline again.
Yeah.
Nothing about moving on.
Lucille Benson gives a very memorable performance as Michael J. Pollard's mom in a way that it's pretty memorable and pretty great. And it's funny and just her extreme take on that person, but it's tragic.
Her greatest performance is in Private Parts.
Private Parts?
The Paul Bartel movie.
I'll have to.
Yeah, she runs a sleazy hotel in San Francisco where there's a lot of strange goings on, and she's got a son who makes love to blow up dolls and injects them with his own blood. It's really quite a
Like a Paul Bartel movie, but I'll give it a look, Joe.
where's the cannibalism? So this was him selling out.
Yeah. This was his first movie.
Oh, it's his first one. Private Parts. I'll check that out. Did no, I mean the that couple. Look, if you said that they had like a Gene like barn in the back, I totally would have bought that. If you just cut to them skinning people going, "Where's Lil?" I would have.
Something weird.
I would not call
film.
I would not
say weird because it's loaded territory. But Redford spends so much time in the film with his shirt off, wearing a hat.
Different hats.
Different hats.
I don't know what the hat budget. As a hat enthusiast, that might be my favorite part of the movie. He has many hats.
Well, was it intentionally? I mean, it's very, the iconography is very gay. I mean, it's very kind of, the leather post kind of thing. And I'm wondering if that was,
I also thought that Brad Pitt on the roof in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was very much a shout out to Little Foss and Big Halsey.
He
is a clone.
Yeah.
The hair, the whole deal is that. And supposedly Redford has distanced himself from this movie.
You couldn't find it forever. And I'd heard that was intentional. Yeah. But I don't know how true that
he
is.
Thought, yeah, maybe not.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
Michael J. Pollard is, he's an interesting guy. Did you work with him? Did you?
No, I never met him.
I worked with him. I acted in a movie he was on. He's very sweet. But later,
he passed away like a year ago, 2 years ago.
Well, later on, when I was directing the Kimmel Show, and when I was directing Jimmy Kimmel, we couldn't get people to come to the live taping. I mean, they would really grab people off the street. But he would show up all the time and sit in the audience and watch the taping.
Maybe he liked the show.
I don't know why he was there. And a few times I would cut to him because he was never watching the show. So it would get a laugh, but I told the camera guy, stop shooting him. This is just, it's gone from being funny to kind of mean, you know, but he would get a laugh. Like, you know, somebody would say something and then he's like looking around.
And he, you know, he was a big deal. I mean, he co-starred in a movie with Robert Redford, and then he had, you know, he was a bit part in Roxanne. Klein. Yeah. But then he was one of the firemen in Roxanne.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah.
You know, and
well, there is something
he played Billy the Kid too. He played the lead in a couple smaller things.
But there is something about him that you just like him. You want him to do well. Yeah. So then you have a guy being just vicious to him and never having that moment where they it's just so strange. Was it intentionally, like, did they intentionally avoid the kind of things like you understand why this guy's horrible or the makeup scene? They just,
I was literally, now that it's watching it again as an adult, I was like, is this like a modern take on a Shakespeare play that I'm unfamiliar with? Because it's not a morality tale, really. It's just a shithead.
Well, what's also interesting, and it goes to the theory about Redford pulling it, there's something about, you know, you're talking about Michael J. Pollard, who could play incredible villains, like just awful people, and you still would walk away going, I really like Michael J. Pollard.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Robert Redford, you're like, you don't walk out I love when some actor will play a villain, a real shitbag. I still think my favorite Tom Cruise movie is Collateral, you know, don't walk out a Little Faust going, wow, I really admire Redford. He's got Ray. You're just like,
yeah, well, it's because he's the best looking guy in the movie.
Right.
You know, it's like Michael J. Pollard is perfect to be a villain. It's like why every James Bond villain has like a cow hand or something. You know, they always have to have a physical deformity, a hoof or something.
Green nipples.
The horrifying traffic stopping.
So what we've learned is that all Bond villains could have been a producer on Bela Lugosi meets the Brooklyn Gorilla. It comes full circle.
It does. It that just makes sense.
I mean, I'm just asking you guys, you're writers, are there rules to anti-heroes or is it because you're watching this movie going, yeah, I think that's how it'd be like to work with Robert Redford? I don't know.
He is a villain. Like an anti-hero is more, you know, that character who's not, he's not necessarily your hero, but is saying things and doing things that I think sort of on some level you wish you could get away with.
Right.
You know,
I was trying to think if is Foss a comment to Faust? Is he the devil? Is he, you know, is that it?
This is the director that did Ladybugs with Rodney Dangerfield. I don't think it gets that deep, Dana.
Well, then you didn't see the same Ladybugs with Rodney Dangerfield that I saw. Do you mean the Carnival of Souls analogy? No, it's like I was really trying to figure out. If there's a thread to Little Foss and Big Halsey and Bela Lugosi Beats a Brooklyn Gorilla, it's I really want to go to the filmmakers. What was the thought here?
Yeah. It was the seed that this tree.
Yeah, get up in the morning, you have some coffee, you get your kids to school, and then you think, I'm going to work and making what? Go
money
yeah, but yeah, I mean,
well, maybe in one of them.
But it seems like it's just such a swing and a miss where I'm all for rooting for people that do despicable things and kind of secretly wish I was that person, but this is just like, nah, didn't care about him.
Yeah.
And then the one guy that my heart always breaks for, you're just going to pick on him for 2 hours and then that's it. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Not that they were asking me what I thought.
But, so here's a question. Here's one that all our listeners can get behind and excited about, I think, because everyone can relate having seen the film. No. Imagine that movie if they had switched the casting.
Yeah.
So we'd watch Michael J. Pollard with his shirt off for the entire time.
yeah. Picking
somehow Noah Beery.
There's an audience for that. I'm not quite sure where.
And somehow Noah Beery and Lucille Benson made Robert Redford.
but you know,
it's the Marilyn Munster story.
there's I don't know what that specific audience is for. I guess it's dad bods, right? If Michael J. I don't, but I will say this, the dirt bike crashes and stuff are a lot of fun. That's pretty cool. But when they cut to Michael J. Pollard on a dirt bike, he looks like when you give a baby a fake steering wheel in a car. he's never been on a bike. He's never been near a bike. He said, all right, look to your left, look to your right. Okay, now look straight forward. That was great, Michael. That's a wrap. He just looks like he's driving. He's in a grocery cart with a steering wheel. That's what he looks like.
That always, even as a kid, that drove me nuts in movies when they weren't obviously not driving, and you'd have actors who would have their hands on the steering wheel and they would just be constantly rotating the wheel.
I used to look when the actor would be driving and looking over at the leading lady while not looking at this.
Right.
And the projection in the back is weaving all over the place.
Yeah. Didn't you do that on did you do that on Police Car? He's eating a sandwich or so. They're like pouring a cup of coffee.
Yeah, we did.
By the way,
we
did I did
a lot of good jokes. On
everything.
I did go and buy the DVD after we spoke last time about Police Squad, and we watched the pilot. And you know, you're talking about who's on first. Who shot first? That is tight as a snare drum. That I actually like it better than who's on first, because it's so straight. Then you shot first. Who's first? He's the guy that owns the bill. It's just that scene is just, and it's funny. My better half Kat had never seen it and it was unaware of it.
Oh wow!
But had such a funny. She was like, oh, this is heightened reality. Like, it's just like, it's such a, like a 30,000 feet view of it. Like the first gag, she was like, get the fuck out of here. Like, and, but it was great to watch somebody see it for the first time.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And I was going the whole time. I was like going, yeah, see, see, this came on when I was in 10th grade and our heads exploded. You know,
do you think that there's cinema comedy where you can do that stuff and then it doesn't translate to television, that it doesn't find an audience on television? You could probably do it now.
No, I think that the problem with that show was that it was a perfect parody of television and it had no laugh track. And right. It looked so much like an old 60s show that the audience, and plus it had Leslie Nielsen, who was known as a straight actor.
Right. And they were just getting mad.
And they just went like, what is an old Leslie Nielsen show doing on network?
Everyone had seen Airplane by that point.
Yeah, I mean, but that was one part. I mean, he hadn't established his comedy.
And had not persona, created him.
Which so he funny, did on the like, show, yeah. And then afterward made lots and lots of, you know, comedies. But
yeah.
but he was a straight actor. This completely reinvented him.
But it was so funny because Mel, I worked with Mel in 2018 and 19, and he was talking about working with Leslie Nielsen on Dracula, Dead and Loving It, and he would go, I'm not a physical person. If I get upset, I yell and then it's over and I try not to ever yell. You know, it's just like, it's not worth it. Life is too short. But if I ever get my hands on the person that told Leslie Nielsen he was funny. He goes like, you're funny. And I explained to him, you're funny being not funny.
Exactly.
When you're not funny, it's hilarious. But he, by that time, was, and he was like, the footage that I burned, let it
go. What do you expect from a guy who carries around a fart machine in his pocket?
Right. I got him. I'm more method in regards to that. But like, that's an example. Like when things were rotten was a lot like Men in Tights. Do
you remember? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, totally.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, am I wrong? Wasn't when things, or wasn't Men in Tights kind of a official?
That's what I'm saying. It's kind of like Police Squad where they get the here's the show, here's the, and the audience is on television, not, but then you put the same tone in a movie.
Right.
It's a big hit and they get it. Maybe
they did get it, but I don't think the movies were as funny as the TV show.
No, they weren't. They weren't. I mean, wow. And to me, it was just like, and you know, it was one of those things where, you know, a book is a movie, then the movie's a play and the play is a thing. You know, it's like, no, this is what this is.
Yeah.
This is the perfect. It's like, you know, Police Squad is to Police Squad what a skunk is to smell. You don't get a more potent version of this than this. This is the thing. And, you know, and it is ironic that the movies were actually more well known because they weren't a patch on the show, in my opinion. Always funny jokes, and thank God gave my very close personal friend O.J. Simpson some work.
He wasn't funny.
There, but here's the thing that blows my mind. The day of the Bronco chase, somebody had a sign on an Uber. Do you know where I'm going with this? That said, "Oh, Norberg."
Oh, no.
Yes. Somebody like,
God, no.
And had the presence of mind to make it and
get out there,
run out to the overpass.
Pretty good. We need to find that person.
Amazing.
So
was it? I feel like there was kind of a thing too back then on TV, which was our younger listeners will have no idea what we're talking about. Where, you know, a show would be on, things were scheduled together. You'd have like, you know, from 8 to 8:30 and 8:30 to 9 would be two different sitcoms. And they would invariably, I feel like they would sort of essentially team shows up with something that was sort of tonally similar.
Sorry, Bewitched and I Dream a Genie were always.
There you go. Or, you know, Cheers and Night Court or what have you. But what could you possibly, there's something about like, but Police Squad was so jarringly its own thing. you know, you couldn't just go straight from Family Ties into Police Squad. It would somehow throw.
Well, it didn't matter because they kept switching it around so many times. Nobody knew when it was on anyway. And then they took it off for like a month. And then when they
I remember chasing
it. Dumped it. They didn't even tell anybody it was on.
I thought the opening where the car went into the house was every episode, but it wasn't.
No.
Oh yeah, that was God. It just kills me.
And then, yeah, killing the guest star.
Especially as somebody who watches
five episodes.
I will. But I watch Dragnet like people eat popcorn. You know, I'll just put on the DVDs and just let them run. I just love them so much.
That's because you can watch it with your mind off.
Yeah, yeah. And those they move like a freight train. And I love the clothes and the whole, I love it's the so whole thing. It's, yeah. It's, Jack was not, he was not interested in that.
He was flying in the face of noir.
Anything that could get him to the cock and bull quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now you know this. You know the story about after Jack before lunch and after lunch. This is not apocryphal. Somebody I don't want to say their name on the air, but they were on a couple of Dragnets and I met them. They were the grandparent of a child in my daughter's kindergarten, and I recognized them in the sort of parent room, and we struck up a friendship and confirmed, like, Jack would come in the morning and you'd get all the coverage. You'd get, you know, and then he'd and they had to get all the coverage by lunch. And if they didn't get to the coverage by lunch, they'd move the clock back so they could get all the coverage by lunch. And then when Jack came back from lunch, he was usually not suited for a close-up. And that's when they did all the masters. So when you look at the tops of the scenes where they're walking, where Jack and Bill are walking into the apartment, half the time he's like not moving his arms when he walks. In the masters, he's half in the bag because they've just come back from lunch.
Now,
it's overlit because it was so they didn't have to change the lighting.
They never changed his wardrobe. He didn't want to deal with continuity. We're the same outfit every episode.
makes it easier. I think I've told you. Did I tell you the Broderick Crawford Highway Patrol story?
About no.
How, they would apparently. I've heard this from several people now. There were days when he was incapable of even standing, and they would lay him down on a floor that looked like a wall, and they would put a filing cabinet. They would put a filing cabinet on the floor next to him, and he would lean on it, and they would point the camera down on him, and he would shoot it as though he was leaning against the filing cabinet.
Back to Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Was it Wallace Beery or Broderick Crawford that was Lon Chaney's drinking and wrestling partner?
No, it was Brod.
Was it Broderick Crawford?
Yeah, no, they were, because when they were at Universal, they used to get snockered and they would destroy dressing rooms.
Yeah, they like to wrestle.
Now, let's see if you guys know if this is a rumor or what, that Fred McMurray on My Three Sons would knock out the season. And
that was part of his contract. They would shoot him in and shoot him out by a particular time, which meant they had to shoot every episode, just the scenes with him. Yeah, and not the coverage with the other people. So they would shoot everything with Fred and then he'd go away and then they'd start back and they'd do everything that he hadn't been in,
included
conversations that people were having with him. it must have been just a logistical nightmare.
I have never in my life more wanted to have a audio cassette labeled The Grumblings of William Demarest. I can't believe that son of a bitch, McMurray.
So like, it started with William Frawley. Killed him.
You're right. It did.
Wow.
It did.
So all the overs are just somebody else. Yeah, like some
if it's
other
a shoulder,
guys.
It's not Fred.
So when it's dirty, it's not Fred.
No,
and then he's
It's Dr. Tom Mason, a famous chiropractor. Yeah, exactly.
And he's
they made a fortune with that show.
And then he's like talking. It's always like, you know, Chip, you know, it's about your family. And, you know, and he's like, fuck you. You're not my real family.
I'm going to be in Santa Barbara.
I think
unbelievable.
I can't believe you guys have eaten up 90 minutes of our time.
I don't know
what we were talking about.
Yeah. When they do a sample episode to prove that we are the most incisive and on the ball interviewers in podcasting, Joe, I feel like this is the episode.
This is usually the point in you know, and by the way, this is just what our show is like. You just happen to be with us.
There's two more people with ADHD.
Yeah. This is around the time where Bob would turn to the crowd and go, by the way, just so you know, this is the show.
Yeah. There always is that point where they're going, did they start? They're just talking.
Did we introduce our guest yet?
No.
Which also, I don't know the name of this. His name escaped me. No.
Oh, sorry.
Makeup artist. Really great guy. Really funny guy. Current guy. I'm blanking on his name. He has the greatest joke. One of my favorite jokes. I'll think of it the minute we're done. And it's
his joke.
Why don't
you just tell us the joke without telling us his name?
Unfortunately, I'm going to have to do that, but I don't want him to hear this and think I'm stealing his joke. The joke is, so King Kong, they find King Kong on an island and they bring him to New York and they put him up on stage and the curtain opens and the people go crazy. The flash bulbs are popping and he breaks loose and tears up New York. If he didn't break loose, what was the show? It's the greatest joke.
I wondered that as a child. Like, what do people think they were going to see?
There's King Kong, and now Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. Hey, Bergen.
While this giant ape just stands there.
He's going to do a song from the Evolution Revolution, the Lance Link band.
How are you, Mata Hari?
That's a lot of peanut butter.
I don't think anybody under the age of 70 is going to understand anything.
That's what they did with Bill Frawley in the last season of My Three Sons. They just gave him a mouthful of peanut butter and they looped him later.
Too soon.
The four people on Earth that got that joke are all on the same show.
I don't know which is going to take longer, is editing this episode or putting out the lexicon so that people can understand it.
I don't think you should cut a word of it.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not going to.
No, this is going to have to be like one of the J.R.R. Tolkien will issue the book that you have to read to understand the book. This is the Cimmerillion of the...
so the movie's Joyride.
Joyride.
If you like this, you're going to love the movie. Because the movie's got a car crash.
I'm glad I'm wearing this headpiece because I feel like I'm talking you down on an airport movie. Come on, Josh, we're going to land this bird.
And this will be dropping on the 26th, which also you guys are going to be doing a live thing on the 26th at Largo. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And then we're off to Portland. So we're doing a little dog and pony show where we do a Q&A. Maybe Dr. Zayas might show up. We don't know.
Dana's
got an in, is all I know.
Yeah. So, we're just touring around. You know, it did remind me. I did this before with like a really small movie. I felt like Bill Castle pulling up. Like I did a Bigfoot movie. So I went every place that had an art house. And was like believed in Bigfoot. So it was all over the Pacific Northwest.
Both those places.
Yeah. No, it was like, it was, you know, Portland, of course, but it's like Bend, Oregon, Salem. It was just, just driving around the West. It was really fun. The cast and I would pull up. It really did remind me of that with the pulling, you know, bringing out the posters and the Bob Dylan of the Bigfoot community. I don't know if you know this. I'm kind of big in the Bigfoot community, but he writes only Bigfoot centric historical songs. And first he shows up, then I introduce him. Then by the end of this tour, he was on stage with a bouncing ball to a song about the Patterson-Gimlin footage. Oh, Joe, I want to ask you about the Hopkinsville.
The original title of the song is No, It's Not John Landis. Yeah. That's not John Landis today.
But I was going down some rabbit hole on the Hopkinsville Goblin and came up.
Well, that's because I've mentioned it in my Trolls from Hell about Invasion of the Saucer Men.
Yeah. Were you familiar with it? I mean, obviously, because the Spielberg script and all that.
No, I was familiar with it because I had read about it beforehand. But I didn't realize until I had read this piece that how much of that movie, Invasion of the Saucer Men, was basically cribbed from the story of the Hopkinsville Goblin.
Wow. But also just so not scary Martians.
Well, that, what was scary is that you keep thinking that these little people who are wearing those heads are going to break their necks.
Yeah.
Their heads are so heavy. And they obviously can't move without it like tipping over.
Whatever planet they were from was the same planet that the Peanuts cast were from. They had these large bulbous heads. But November, the first or second week of November, I'm driving to Kentucky to go there and research that and stuff because I am fascinated. Oh yeah, okay. I'm fascinated by that.
It's a good story.
Just for fun, or are you doing something?
No, but I mean,
he's remaking Invasion of the Saucer Men, which is a perfectly good movie to remake.
Further establish my bona fides. Those heads were built and designed by Paul Blaisdell. Thank you.
That's right. But he was too big to wear them. Usually he wore his own stuff, but he couldn't wear that.
Why do I know all this stuff? Two words. The ladies. No, you had the correct one.
It is. You know, a Blaisdell reference is definitely...
Oh, it's catnip.
Catnip for the women.
There's no rabbit hole. Our
most accessible episode.
There's no rabbit hole. No rabbit hole too small.
But I do feel that, the Gremlins were kind of probably closer to... What
they probably looked like. Yeah,
yeah. This is really fascinating. Yeah, so I'm taking a field trip there, and I'm going to...
Well, that's good. You got to come back and tell us what you find.
Yeah, I'm going to talk to as many folks as I can. And
they're still alive.
There's a lot of, children of the people.
Oh, good, because this took place in the mid-50s, I think.
Yeah, and also, doesn't help your case when two of the witnesses are carnies. I rest my case. This is Seal of the Seal Boy. Would you like to speak? All right. Yeah, I can feel you've been trying to wrap
this up. They're the last group you're allowed to say that about, I think, is carnies.
Carnies.
It's just an untrustworthy people in general. Is that right?
Yeah.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you so much. Oh, the movie's coming out Friday. You can see them at Largo. You guys are going to be playing what? Chuckles Ha Ha House next week?
Yeah, is that?
Dr. Grins.
But folks can, if you actually pre-order it on iTunes, it helps us because it moves us up in the queue.
Yes. Yeah. And I really, we sort of make a point of the show's not fun if we don't like it. You did too, right, John? We really, 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 really enjoyed this doc.
Oh, thanks.
Very good.
Thank you. And yeah. I will take this opportunity to say it's we're both in the movie, but it's Bob's movie. Bob took all that footage and made it into a movie. I'm just stage meat.
You know what was a great day was when I was looking over the footage and went, I'm the villain. I gotta really show what an asshole I can be or there's no story. So that was not a great day.
you'll really like Joy Ride. You should take a look at it. It's no Bela Lugosi meets the Brooklyn Gorilla. It's got the same running time. So
can we have our pull quote.
Our show was recorded from several well-stocked bunkers. We can't wait to get back to beautiful downtown Burbank. We're the official podcast of TrailersFromHell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for The Movies That Made Me. Stay safe out there, folks.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from the Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that because you're already listening to a podcast.